With that, I will now turn it over to our moderator, Dr. Thad Shook from NIEHS, for opening remarks. Thad, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Thad Shug. I'm a program officer at NIEHS. So it's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker. We'll start with Stephen Ferguson, an investigator with the Mechanistic Toxicology Branch of the Division of Translational Toxicology, or DTT, leading multiple research initiatives to model and predict human responses to chemical exposures. He will discuss liver and kidney spheroid cultures used to model chemical toxicity and disease. So, Dr. Ferguson, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Thad. And let me share my screen. So are you able to see my screen and hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for inviting me today, all the organizers, particularly given that Bevan Englewood, who I am not, was not able to be here today, but I am excited to share some of the work that we've been doing as we are both kindred spirits in our aspirations for organotypic in vitro models that help us better understand chemical toxicity and safety. Today, I'm going to share many of the learnings that we've had over recent years towards advancing translational toxicology research with these types of models. And I must acknowledge as a federal employee that I have no financial relationships to disclose, and the statements and opinions and conclusions that I make are my own. So in the early models of human liver, such as these HepG2 cells that you're seeing on the right, these immortalized cancer cells that are proliferating on a plastic dish, they hold little resemblance to the functional elegance and complexity of the human liver tissue. And this is, while these models have been useful, this is a particular challenge. These cells are proliferating, they adhere to rigid plastic and really incapable of many of the differentiated hallmarks that we might observe in the organ. But we've learned a great deal in recent decades about how to model liver epithelium using patient-derived cells to better resemble the architectures. So you see here in this small caption, this cobblestone-like network of cells. And you're seeing that when these primary cells are isolated with sufficient viability and fidelity, and they're able to be reassembled into tissue-like architectures that begin to behave much like the tissues. And so this is an exciting opportunity to begin to evaluate chemical safety with microphysiological systems. However, a major challenge with these patient-derived cells is once they're ripped out of their native architecture, they rapidly dedifferentiate. And without intervention, these cells will essentially become dead. They just lose all their viability. They do have some short-term applications in drug metabolism, but outside of that, it's a real challenge to do this work. However, pioneering work from one of my mentors and many others in the field, in this case, highlight Ed Laclus, and his colleagues revealed critical factors for reestablishing epithelial-like canalicular networks with these patient-derived cells to allow them to begin to manifest hallmarks of hepatocellular function. And the key to this is culturing the cells with sufficient density to enable them to be more three-dimensional, to be able to enable them to be more cuboidal in their structures that resembles better the in vivo architecture. And in doing so, we see rescue and recovery, maintenance of a number of hallmarks such as drug metabolism activity and signal transduction pathways that regulate the expression of drug metabolizing enzymes and a myriad of other transporters and related toxicological pathways. And so these fundamental principles appear to be operative for many other epithelial tissues as well, not just the liver. But we're learning from this over recent decades and how we can begin to use these principles to develop more sophisticated microphysiological systems that are able to achieve tissue-like functionality. And The good news is many of these systems have actually matriculated from concept and research into regulatory context. Presently, creating these types of culture systems and integrating assay platforms that allow us to make interpretations and predictions for drug metabolism and drug-drug interactions can enable us to then make regulatory decisions and put labels on new drugs that basically indicate whether there's a likelihood of a response or whether clinical trials are needed. And so the challenge we have is that for chemical safety research, this is not the case, as we are trying to much more extensively cover the myriad of effects that could happen in an animal or in a human. And in along that route, we collect more than 120 tissues in a guideline animal study. We collect biofluids. Many, many things can happen. And what's even more challenging is that these culture models, while they've been effective, are really limited. The traditional culture systems are in static culture conditions in these sort of semi-2D environments. They exhibit poor nutrient exchange and are tethered to rigid plastic in a survival mode that has super physiological concentrations of insulin and many other factors. And so these are, in essence, dying disease models that have a limited utility, but for chemical safety research are really challenging. And so that's led to sort of an explosion of different tissue engineering systems that have envisioned a way to sort of maintain patient-derived cells with higher fidelity for weeks and months of exposure that include three-dimensional platforms, microfluidic and barrier models, as well as multi-tissue axes, where we begin to combine the liver and, say, the thyroid or other models that these tissues sort of work together in vivo in an axis of pathophysiology in response to chemical exposures. And so how can we begin to look at this landscape of things alongside useful enzyme and biomarker assays to then begin to make decisions about chemical safety research? And these systems really do have a lot of potential, but what's challenging right now is that we're not able to fully establish the context of use for all these different systems. There's a wide range of them. And then we ultimately have to do the heavy lifting to qualify these systems, to calibrate how to use data from these systems with human therapeutics to understand xenobiotic exposure responses with environmental chemicals, drugs, botanicals, and other things. So to address these needs, we've been advancing research and development efforts in multiple avenues. And one of the key partnerships that I'd like to highlight today has been our work with the TexVal Consortium, led by Yvonne Roosen at Texas A&M, to explore the landscape of these different systems and in collaboration with industry and government researchers, and led by laboratory technical experts like Courtney Sokolish in his lab. The TexVal team has comparatively evaluated a range of microphysiological systems and provided methods to partner labs like ours that help us to extend this kind of technology that's coming out of academic research into additional research applications. And so we're really excited about continuing this partnership as we evaluate a number of device systems and look at clinical biomarker assays. In our laboratory here at NIHS, we've been working to extend emerging science and technology to understand and predict human responses to drug, natural product, and environmental chemical exposures for many years. And our laboratory looks to develop these microphysiological systems alongside biomarker assays and high-dimensional assays that give us mechanistic insights, and then ultimately using computational models interpret those assays into decision contexts. And we've been doing that work for quite a while. And really, our primary aims are to develop and qualify these physiologically relevant microphysiological systems and assays into NAMs that are actually relevant and useful, and to lead into innovative toxicological investigations of environmental substances. And I'll speak about some of our work today on PFAS and aqueous film-forming foams. And then to address critical gaps in NAM-based toxicology research. Our pioneering work in introducing free-floating spheroid cultures in human hepatocytes for chemical safety research has revealed these little powerhouse liver microtissues can be robust little engines that are able to emulate hallmarks of hepatocellular function. And what's really great about these is they support not just days of exposure that we could see in our 2D cultures, but actually months of high fidelity functionality. They're able to then, as a result of that, help us to predict the potency ranges for drug-induced liver injury, and they're highly efficient and cost efficient, and as they use so many fewer cells compared to a standard two-dimensional culture model. And this is the type of model that Bevan and I have been working on for a number of years, and we're really excited to see how these can work. And in particular, I would just highlight the fact that they begin to polarize and form liver-like architecture just spontaneously. That's much more elaborate than what we see in two-dimensional cultures. Now, one of the sort of key hallmarks of hepatocellular function that's really distinguished the less evolved or differentiated systems like iPS-derived hepatocytes and HepG2 cells from the liver tissue and suspensions of hepatocytes that we've seen is their drug metabolism proficiency. And so in this sort of this is your life photo. You see an example on the left where we're looking at the median drug metabolism activity for CYP1A2, 2B6, and 3A4 across hundreds of donor preparations of human hepatocytes. And so in comparing that median to where we were in tox 21 in using immortalized cells, you can see we had just minimal metabolic activity for these major clinical enzymes that are important for drug clearance in humans. And in 2D models of human hepatocytes, you can see how they're about only 10% of what we see in terms of their initial starting point. So even then, we see that they're dedifferentiating to some extent. But what we were excited to discover is that when we took the surrogate for primary human hepatocytes that we've been using, these HepaRG cells, we found that when you cultured them in increasingly sophisticated culture conditions, that we saw a dramatic increase in the enzymatic activities that began to rival what we see in the median suspension human hepatocytes. And so this suggests not only that they're able to be responsive to the culture conditions, but they're also indicating that there's something really special going on in these free-floating microtissues. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But what we're excited about is not only are these metabolically proficient, they're also able to retain liver-like signal transduction pathways. They're not just emulating zone three of the liver, but they're further inducible, analogous to liver tissue, to mimic these major hepatic receptor signaling pathways, many of which are involved in cancer, and to polarize, as I mentioned earlier, to form these biliary excretion networks that enable them to not be cholestatic, but to actually be a viable model that's actively effluxing bile acids into these bile pockets and then ultimately out into the media. But with their small size, that dilution is quite good. And with the Brownian motion that can happen in moving around, we think that they're really exquisite in their ability to exchange nutrients and waste products and achieve this level of metabolic proficiency. And we found that when we looked at drug analogs like trovafloxacin versus levofloxacin that had varied clinical outcomes for liver injury, we were able to readily distinguish the hepatotoxic molecules from the non-hepatotoxic molecules. Troglitazone and rosiglitazone was another example. And we've had many of these. While we look at molecules like aspirin and gemfibrozil that have minimal reports of liver injury, and these models seem to be able to emulate that type of effect. And we've dug more deeply into these mechanisms and pathways. And we've also applied them in some ways to external things. So botanicals are particularly an area where we have intentional human exposures. And Adam Pearson in the lab was able to take these microtissue type models and apply them under our Botanical Safety Consortium research using these 384 plates. And a combination of cell painting and diagnostic type assays for liver enzyme leakage and albumin production and CYP3A4 inhibition, as well as transcriptomics, have enabled us to create data for a number of manuscripts in this space. and really demonstrated to us the power of these little microtissues to inform a variety of applications. And I'll talk a bit more about some of those in the next few slides. But one of the things I wanted to highlight to folks is that when we look at the longevity of 2D primary rat hepatocytes, it's typically 3 to 5 days, and then the cells are really starting to struggle and die. But those same cells in these 3D microtissues have months of longevity, and not only longevity, but functional longevity, and able to sort of rescue metabolic proficiency, respond to those CAR type activators and other signaling pathways, and stain histologically in collaboration with Dr. Darling Dixon to reflect the same types of architecture that we see in liver tissue, in this case, glycogen staining and CK19 staining for cholangiocyte-like cells. And what this enables is now an ability to bridge the gap between our animal studies and our human studies using this parallelogram type approach of microtissues that we can compare between rat and human. And we know these systems do emulate interspecies comparisons, and the molecular potencies across species can oftentimes be very predictive. And so we're excited to see how this type of enabling technology can expand to complement our animal studies, and really, due to their small size, even give us an opportunity to reduce the number of animals that we're using in toxicology research while we're building confidence in their contexts of use. So we've also been integrating omics assays, and a few years back, we published this power of resolution manuscript that describes our efforts to develop high-throughput transcriptomics with these types of models. And we were able to successfully show that this platform defined a threshold, a transcriptomically defined threshold that enables you to define the relative potency across a range of compounds based on where they cross this threshold. And using these types of data, we can now distinguish drug-induced liver injury compounds like trofafloxacin and levofloxacin, both qualitatively and in terms of their relative potencies. And so that begins to create an opportunity for predictive toxicology and chemical safety that better defines margins of exposure and the potency ordering of those firing sequences that occurs between biological effects that might be off target or, reversible adaptive responses relative to those that are stressful and cytotoxic is a key opportunity within these types of data to just sort of resolve the relative potencies of biological responses. And then relating those with biomarkers of clinical pathology and cellular imaging begins to build confidence. And one example that I highlight here is with aflatoxin, where we were actually able to observe scarring that occurred in these 2D cultures of HEPA-RG. And we were able to observe clearly that at those same concentration ranges, we were getting molecular pathway responses related to injury and repair and DNA damage. And so this type of response with aflatoxin B1 just highlights the potential for these types of systems to more comprehensively inform chemical safety research. And we're excited to see where these can go. And we've actually applied them recently in an ES&T publication where we've been looking deeply in support of the Department of Defense and their needs to identify safer aqueous film-forming foams for military use. And in our coordination with them, published this manuscript that basically is highlighting an evaluation of 30 test substances that included 5 aqueous film-forming foams and a large number of PFAS, perfluorinated alkyl substances, as well as human drugs that helped to anchor the data set. And we in this work, we were able to use a combination of this transcriptomic thresholding approach to predict the potencies for liver injury. We were also able to use multiple data streams to build a weight of evidence for that in these systems. We were able to, as with the drugs, we were able to identify mechanistic pathway potencies. And then to define biological response similarities, such as what you see here by comparing PFAS, which is a very extensively studied PFAS and is known to be toxic, with structurally similar but shorter chain PFHXS, and this poorly understood and data poor molecule 6,2-fluorotelomersulfonate. And what we see is that they share a great deal of biological response similarity in these human hepatocyte microtissue models. And so the idea is to continue to help support our regulatory needs for read across. And these type of data help us to decide whether these alternative or more modern molecules are toxic and what's the relative potency for those. We also have expanded that biological response similarity analysis to sort of more fully capture which chemicals are similar to one another, but more importantly, to anchor their aggregate biological effects at the very low concentrations with model compounds like YF14643, which is a known activator of the peroxisome proliferator activator receptor alpha, or omeprazole and phenobarbital, which can activate the pregnan X receptor and the constitutive Ehlers-Danlos receptor, as well as a cluster here that was just containing cyclosporin A and a bunch of aqueous film-forming foams that might be more related to lipid disruption. As we know, cyclosporin A can cause fatty liver. And so taking all of these sort of similarity relationships in mind, we can begin to also think about not only supporting our EPA colleagues and read across, but we also can begin to predict apical outcomes. And so in this case, we took the relative potencies for CAR, PPAR activation, and liver injury that are well-established modes of hepatomegaly, and then to use that to predict whether we are what are the concentrations in vivo in the animal, and those are shown in the blue or the purple triangles here, the concentrations at which we see in vivo effects to enlarge the liver. And what we're seeing is that when we look at these pathway potencies in human hepatocytes relative to the in vivo liver weight LOEL, we're getting a reasonable overlap. And so we're able to predict the animal LOEL using internal doses. And we've taken all these types of data and begun to extend them, both in terms of our in vivo investigation of PFAS bioaccumulation from aqueous film-forming foam exposures, our in vivo biology from AFFF exposures, and our in vitro mechanistic data to begin to enable development of prioritization frameworks that can identify safer products and ultimately help to improve our environment with safer options. So we've also identified that PFAS accumulation is one of the fundamental concerns with PFAS, and we've been able to use tissue chip platforms such as the Emulate platform to demonstrate we can distinguish long and short half-life PFAS from one another based on their renal reuptake. So in this case, we established a kidney tissue chip system, and we're able to show PFAS extensively accumulated in epithelial cells from apical exposures compared to PFBS. And we've done similar work with the liver and liver microtissues to demonstrate distinctions between the long and the short chain PFAS. And we're also interested in addressing the more than 15,000 PFAS that have been identified in commerce by the US EPA in recent publications, and to use computational models, including the bioconcentration factor, to help stratify PFAS, even if they don't cross historical thresholds, and using combinations of bioconcentration and hepatic clearance to be able to tier these molecules, these more than 15,000 molecules, into testable units that help us fill the data gaps. I want to switch back to the three-dimensional microtissue models now and just show you a couple of examples where these microtissue models in 3D convey superior ability to distinguish hepatotoxicant responses with valproic acid and cyclophosphamide. So here we're looking at two compounds that require metabolic activation. And what we see is robust responses in 3D compared to very small responses in 2D cultures. And so these are two of the sort of less common examples, but clear examples where metabolic activation may be a toxicity determining step. With benzoylpha-pyrene, we actually saw the opposite effect. With our proliferating HepaRG, we saw they were more sensitive than the 3D microtissues. And this may be related to the fact that benzoylpha-pyrene is causing DNA damage, and the rate determining step for toxicity is different. And so one of these may be more predictive than the other, and we're continuing to investigate this, but it's not always the case that three-dimensional cultures are more sensitive. And so we're digging into this more deeply. And we've done this type of analysis for many, many drugs. And one of the sort of interesting trends we've seen when we look at transcriptomic pathway enrichment is that 3D hepatocyte cultures tend to be much more extensively enriched for anticipated or known targets of these compounds. So you're looking at a range of compounds that have known targets: fenofibric acid for PPAR signaling, phenobarbital for CAR signaling, rosiglitazone for PPAR signaling. And what we see across the board is a better enrichment in 3D compared to 2D 2D culture models. And so in aggregate, this is telling us something, in addition to the fact that many of these models are more predictive across the board. And we're excited to see how this type of knowledge can then really increase our ability to do predictive toxicology. Just want to highlight near the end here just a couple of quick points. So we've been working not only in liver, which is the vast majority of our work, but Adam Pearson also established in our lab methods for looking at proximal tubule. We particularly know that the kidney is one of the target tissues of highest concern, and the proximal tubule being the most vulnerable. And he discovered that these small microtissues of renal proximal tubule cells actually remember how large the proximal tubule was in vivo, and they just autoassemble into these small tubuloids, is what we're calling them. And in comparing the 2D cultures with domes, so these would be considered a differentiated 2D culture that's forming a fluid pocket under the epithelium, we're seeing sensitized response to compounds like cisplatin. And we've done a number of compounds, about 37 compounds we screened with this platform, and those publications are in preparation. And finally, I just want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. When I joined the NIHS, one of the big things that we were concerned about is, in an animal model, anything could happen. So we're trying to understand what it is that we can predict with NPS and NAM-based systems. And to address this question, we first need to understand, well, what do we normally look for? And so I turned to the NTP's histopathology glossary, where there are 1,000 lines of things that a pathologist could find in an animal. And I basically started to map those morphologies and those locations, and trying to then say, well, in a liver microphysiological system, what could we potentially see with the existing or emerging models? And then work to develop a Rosetta Stone that translates liver NPS data into recognizable pathology findings that we can then meet the regulators and other decision makers in a more recognizable place, and then ultimately calibrating those with drugs so that we can quantitatively use them. And just to show you a high-level summary of what I was able to determine, but essentially, even though we're only looking at one tissue out of the 120 that you might collect, and we're not really able to identify all the locators across all of pathology, we are starting to make an impact in the number of morphologies and modifiers that we could observe there. And I'm going to be going more into this and partnering with folks in pathology to sort of roll these out and vet them as we go further. But I think the initial point is to say we're trying to understand what it is we want to predict, and then to tune microphysiological systems towards these endpoints that can then be used in decision making. And finally, I'm going to leave you with future directions. We're already working to manifest toxicological phenotypes, as I mentioned, and this pathology sort of mindset. We also want to begin to do a much better job in addressing factors of inter-individual susceptibility to chemical exposures. We have oftentimes adult models because that's where clinical trials are run, but we don't have models of fetal although iPS-derived cells could be used in that way, geriatric childhood neonatal, we don't have those. It's sad to say we don't have sexually dimorphic culture conditions for hepatocytes. We put them in a monosex medium, and we may use donors from a male and female, but we need to do a much better job of this. Genetic predisposition and disease haplotypes. And then probably most importantly, from a susceptibility standpoint, is modeling pre-existing disease like steatosis. We're starting to do that now with high-fat media, and then looking to see how these might differentially sensitize to chemical toxicity. And then finally, just expanding tissue coverage and axes of pathophysiology, as I mentioned earlier, the liver, thyroid axis, and the concerns with PFAS. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions. And just really, it's an honor to work at the NIHS with such an amazing group of talented scientists. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve. So listeners, you can enter questions through the question answer pod. And it looks like we have a few already on deck here. So how do you deal with floating HEPA RG cells that do not readily aggregate into spheroids?
Yeah. So if the HEPA RG cells are not aggregating into spheroids, there's probably something not ideal in the culture conditions. They will self-aggregate if the cell numbers and the cell configurations are correct. And we often find a more conical shape will make that happen faster, but it typically takes between 3 and 7 days for those cells to coalesce into a microtissue. And now once they're formed into that microtissue, we do use special plates, and there are a few different types. Some plates are more or less sensitive to the floating, but we use standard liquid handler, in our case, the Viaflow, that we stamp a 3 to 4 well plate. We remove half the media, and in some cases, we remove 80 or 90% of the media, and then process the cells that way. But it's pretty straightforward. The primary hepatocytes tend to be more dense than the HEPA RGs after about 10 days in culture. So that's one distinction that we've observed. But that's how we handle floating HEPA-RG is that they settle to the bottom. And with liquid handling, where you're only exchanging about half the medium every other day or every day, it's no problem.
Okay, the next question. Can you comment on how your assays, such as HEPA-RG, stack up? Oops, gotta fix this here. Wait, just 1 second.
Against mouse models.
Yes, against mouse models, do you see the same responses?
Yeah, we haven't made mouse spheroids yet. We've made rat. We feel very comfortable that we're seeing things that make sense there. We know that 2D models of mouse are good, but very short term. They're even shorter lived than the rat. And so, but there have been reports of mouse spheroids being formed, and they should be a good model. And again, you would use far fewer mice because they don't each well would require a very small amount of cells. And so I'm very encouraged by what I've seen so far with the rat, but we haven't done the mouse work yet.
Thank you. So, are you comparing biological pathway readouts using MPS, et cetera, with responses seen in human population studies? If so, how do these compare?
Yeah, we haven't in our lab gotten to that point. I think we would be looking to partner with researchers who have existing, epidemiological observations and hypotheses. And what we're thinking about is more developing those states of susceptibility. And we don't know what our end's going to be yet for any given state, but the idea is to capture those states, and then we'll do power calculations to understand how many we would need to see what effect. And for acute effects, the numbers probably won't be that large. But when we start to get to something that's slower developing and it takes a much longer exposure, the N's going to likely increase. And so I think that's where the scientific community has to decide what's the value of, digging deeper compared to the decisions you could make shorter term. But that we're a long ways from being able to do that type of work, but the technology at scale is there to do it.
So, next question. Are we missing the inflammatory contributors to toxicology or toxicity in these models? And
That's a
any comments?
great comment, and we are and we're not. So some of the models that I showed you have resident macrophages, the Kupffer cells that are already in these microtissues, and when they're in a happy 3D microtissue, they become quiescent. If they're not already, typically they're already isolated to be quiescent, and then they will become activated when toxicity occurs. What we don't have is circulating macrophages in your typical microtissue model. And so being able to see infiltration and a lot of things you're going to see in pathology is something that could be done, might be more amenable to some of the tissue chip systems where there's been some progress with that, but it could also work with microtissues with the right tuning. We just haven't gotten far enough to do that. But there is an inflammatory component there, but it's not, the amplifier is probably not there to really, manifest organ level toxicity.
Okay, next question. What might be correlated more by microtissue 3D systems, the toxokinetic or toxicodynamic aspects?
Well, if we've done it properly, it should be both, but that's a great point. These microtissues are very small, and so they don't reflect the allometric scaling of blood to liver. And so we have to tune and calibrate these systems for the decision context that they're useful for. But what I can say as a general principle is if we've modeled the toxicokinetics in a relevant way, the toxicodynamics and the translation of an individual effect, whether it's benign or toxic, should be more accurate. And what we're seeing in these microtissue models and other MPS systems that they have a better capacity to partition their own internal exposure better than we would think. But still, there are going to be limitations unless we have a full accounting for that. And that's why I'm really interested in pooled spheroid models where we can have a much bigger liver than we do a thyroid or other tissues so that we can try to scale those axes to have metabolomic endocrine paracrine signaling that's more equivalent to what we would see in vivo and how those tissues would adapt and interact with one another.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your presentation, Stephen. It was terrific and also perfect timing. So let's move on to our second presentation today. Next, we have Susan Tilton, the Associate Professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University and a project leader at Oregon State University Superfund Research Center. Her lab uses molecular and computational tools to predict toxicity of chemical contaminants in the environment. Dr. Tilton will introduce a 3D human lung respiratory model of asthma. So, Dr. Tilton, please feel free to begin when you're ready.
All right, thank you. So let me see. Just make sure that you can hear me okay and you can see my slides.
Yes, we can.
Okay. Well, thank you for that introduction, and thank you for the invitation to speak today. As that said, I'm an associate professor and project principal investigator for the Oregon State University and Pacific Northwest National Laboratory Superfund Research Center. So today I plan to share with you some of our work using primary human bronchial epithelial cells cultured at the air-liquid interface as a 3D model to investigate health effects of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons associated with both contaminated sites and wildfire smoke. So I'd like to begin just by briefly highlighting our center and our integrated projects and cores. So our center is titled the Center for Science, Technology, and Emerging Health Risk of PAHs. It's driven by a mission to identify PAHs in the environment, characterize their toxicity, determine environmental concentrations below which they pose minimal risk to human health, and also to develop safe and sustainable approaches for remediating pH contaminated sites. So, overall, our goals are to understand the composition of these complex mixtures containing pHs, how they can change in the environment, and the implications for both these pHs and mixtures for human health. Our research program relies heavily on the use of integrated new approach methodologies or NAMs. So this includes cell-based systems, non-mammalian whole animal models like zebrafish, and in silico approaches that are used throughout the program. And today I'll talk about some work in collaboration in particular with Jordan Smith in the Predictive Dosimetry and Metabolism Core. Also coupled to passive sampling techniques to quantify environmental fate and human exposure to chemicals. So together, these tools allow us to efficiently link environmental measurements with biologically relevant human outcomes. Some of the key goals for my project in particular include using 3D respiratory models to establish quantitative relationships between chemical exposure and toxicity. Advancing these systems to predict pH toxicity in susceptible populations, and then understanding mechanisms driving lung toxicity from novel substituted pHs and those in complex mixtures. So this is particularly relevant for multi-source exposures near Superfund sites, which in the Pacific Northwest often include concurrent exposures to wildfire smoke, for example, among others. So I'll focus on some of these goals today. In addition, within our program, an essential component is just the engagement with state and federal agencies, industry partners, and local communities. So through these collaborations, we communicate our science to support informed decision making related to the assessment, management, and remediation of contaminated sites throughout our region. So I've mentioned that our program focuses on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These are ubiquitous contaminants in the environment that can occur from both naturally occurring and anthropogenic sources. pHs account for three of the top 10 chemicals of concern at priority pollutant sites and are associated with multiple adverse health effects. Our Superfund program in particular, over a number of years, has identified both parent pHs and transformation products that are formed in the environment across multiple phases in soil, water, and air associated with Superfund sites and other hazardous waste sites. In addition, I wanted to highlight through some of the work in Kim Anderson's project. So she's a project lead in our program. Working towards identifying that alkylated pHs in particular rank among the most abundant pHs measured in environmental samples from multiple sources. So this includes petrochemicals associated with Superfund sites and thermal decomposition of organic matter. So for example, in this case, where passive samplers were deployed in air and water at a brownfield creosote site, at all locations and sampling dates, we can see that alkylated pHs that are summed here by the blue dots were more abundant than the unsubstituted or parent pHs that are quantified by the orange dots. So this is in both air and surface water, and again, across all sites and time points. Her group has also observed in passive sampling with wristbands. So these are used to measure personal exposure to PAHs that seasonally many of the more highly abundant PAHs that are measured are 2 to 3 ring alkylated PAHs. So some of the primary sources during summer are associated with wildfire smoke exposure, or in the winter with indoor sources like indoor heating or cooking. So while priority PAHs and those shown here, which include these 16 unsubstituted parent PAHs, are the ones that we continue to know the most about in terms of their toxicity, their potential for human exposure, and frequency of occurrence at hazardous waste sites. There are more than 1,500 chemicals total in the broader class of polycyclic aromatic compounds that include pHs with diverse structural features and substitutions that we currently have very little data on in terms of sources, exposure, toxicity, and mechanisms. So overall, our program focuses on these novel pHs and particularly these highly abundant alkylated pHs, which are also found as part of environmentally relevant mixtures. We have tested a number of these 3 to 5 ring alkylated pH families for toxicity in primary human bronchial epithelial cells and found that many of the alkylated pHs cause toxicity at lower concentrations than their unsubstituted parents or unsubstituted forms across multiple endpoints, so including cytotoxicity, oxidative stress, mitochondrial membrane potential, and also including DNA damage. So in this table, the asterisks indicate that the alkylated pH listed cause a statistically significant response at a concentration lower than its corresponding parent. So all of the parents are highlighted in boxes and their corresponding alkylated forms are listed below. So while we're still in the process of analyzing this data, we can preliminarily say that we are observing that alkylated pHs may cause toxicity through unique mechanisms compared to their parent, potentially also causing genotoxicity uniquely compared to parent forms. And collectively, this data really suggests that current risk assessments may underestimate pH risk from inhalation exposure due to lack of data and lack of our knowledge about contribution to toxicity from these alkylated forms. So, in order to study toxicity from inhaled pHs, our lab primarily works with 3D airway organotypic culture models. So, this is a cell system in which primary human cells are differentiated at the air-liquid interface, or ALI. Primary human bronchial epithelial cells are collected from donors and then cultured on a transmembrane insert. And in this case, under conditions in which they're allowed to differentiate for approximately 25 days to induce a three-dimensional structure with these multiple cell types that mimic the lining of the bronchial epithelium. So in our model, the cells differentiate into the pseudostratified structure with ciliated cells, mucus-producing goblet cells, producing stem-like basal cells, among others, to allow us to more accurately reflect exposure at tissue interfaces and better recapitulate in vivo response. Towards the end of my talk today, I will spend some time highlighting how we are continuing to work, develop, and modify our ALI models to study disease phenotypes, also generate co-culture models to better reflect in vivo systems. Overall, and Stephen referenced this very well in his talk too, these types of advanced cell culture models and organotypic models, which can range from these differentiated cell models all the way to tissue models, are really an important part of this translational pipeline in toxicology, helping us translate from in silico and simple in vitro testing to what we know about adverse outcomes in humans. And while they can potentially serve as a replacement for animal models and also serve to supplement our knowledge from animals and human relevant systems, these complex models also allowed for translation to humans and improved understanding of key events leading to adverse outcomes for better predictions of toxicity. As I mentioned at the beginning, early on, one of our goals is to use our 3D respiratory model to establish a quantitative relationship between chemical exposure and toxicity and make comparisons between our cell model and tissues from an in vivo system. So, in collaboration with Jordan Smith in the Predictive Metabolism and Dosimetry Core at the Pacific Northwest National Lab, We've developed a dosimetry or physiologically based pharmacokinetic model to improve our ability to translate between endpoints that we measure in vitro to toxicity or health outcomes that can occur in humans. So historically, PBPK models have been utilized in what's called a forward dosimetry approach to predict tissue concentrations from human exposure doses for use in extrapolating to animal studies. But in our studies, we want to use the PBPK model to develop a reverse dosimetry model for predicting human exposure concentrations from in vitro data, with the idea that concentrations that cause toxicity in cells would then mimic concentrations at the tissue level. So to do this, we need to collect data in our model on the disposition and metabolism of pHs within our culture system. And so I was going to spend some time walking through our efforts to do this. We had broken our model down into compartments with the goal to quantify metabolism and distribution across dose and time and develop parameters for the dosimetry model. So our fractions reflect the mucus apical compartment, the cells, the media or plasma compartment, and then we also wanted to evaluate potential loss of pHs that may bind to plastic material. We developed the model using the pH benzoylpyrene just as a reference chemical, also because we do have a lot of information about benzoylpyrene and knowledge about its metabolites and standards for those metabolites. So we use benzoylpyrene to develop parameters, to collect parameters actually for developing essentially two models, a model to describe the parent chemical, benzoylpyrene itself, and how it moves within our system, and then also develop a model describing formation of metabolites, particularly those that contribute to the formation of the diol epoxide leading to DNA damage. So before looking at the metabolite data, we first tracked how benzoylpyrene moved in our culture system between compartments across multiple time points up to 48 hours after exposure. We were able to recover approximately 100% of benzoylpyrene that was put into the system. And we see the amount of benzoylpyrene then decrease over time as we would expect metabolites to form. So when we looked at benzoylpyrene in each compartment, we can see that benzoylpyrene will leave the mucus apical compartment over time. We can see it moving into the cells up to 4 hours before also decreasing. We see some benzoylpyrene moving into the media, but if you look at the y-axis, you can tell that this is at much lower levels than we're measuring benzoylpyrene in the other compartments. So actually, very little of the parent benzoylpyrene itself is moving into the media fraction. We also really were not able to identify benzoylpyrene bound to plastic, and so this did not serve as a significant source of loss for benzoylpyrene from our system. So, to measure metabolite formation, we also collected samples at multiple time points up to 48 hours for extraction and analysis by UPLC with fluorescence detection. So, this is a schematic for benzoylpyrene metabolism. We see benzoylpyrene here in the center and different metabolites that can form through various pathways. So while we aren't able to quantify all of the metabolites, we can quantify many of them that we have standards for. And so those are listed here. And out of those metabolites, we were primarily able to detect these six metabolites that are highlighted in red, and we can see from the UPLC trace the peaks for these metabolites. So this includes a number of metabolites, but particularly, as I mentioned, we were interested in those associated with the formation of the diol epoxide, benzoate pyrene 7-8 diol 9-10 epoxide, that can interact with DNA and cause DNA damage. So we were able, while we can't measure the diol epoxide itself due to stability, we can measure metabolites upstream. So we can measure the 7-8 diol and also the tetrols downstream. So after we look at formation of metabolites over time, we can see formation of a number of metabolites. And I'm just going to highlight an increase in the 7-8 diol in blue, and an increase in the tetrols in red, that are formed over time. And again, these are upstream and downstream of the diol epoxide. We also see that metabolites account for the majority of benzoyl-A-pyrene that's recovered at later time points. So we start to really see measurable metabolites contributing to total recovery at 8 hours, and then this contributes to a majority of the metabolites that are formed at the later time points. So while detection of these metabolites indicate that we are likely generating the diol epoxide itself, leading to DNA damage, we did also evaluate DNA damage in cells after treatment using a COMET-based assay in collaboration with Bevan Engelward's lab at MIT. This assay detects single-strand breaks mediated by genotoxic intermediates generated through metabolism of PAHs. This method uses trapping agents to block repair mechanisms, so damaged DNA can be viewed as COMETs. And you can see examples here of undamaged DNA and DNA after treatment. So, using this assay, we were able to detect a dose-dependent increase and the DNA damage with benzoylpyrene in the presence of trapping agents, which are here on the right-hand side, but not when trapping agents were not included in our negative controls, where we aren't able to observe significant DNA damage after benzoylpyrene treatment. So this suggests that the damage that we were seeing was mediated by generation of these reactive intermediates of pH metabolism. So we were observing DNA damage at 24 hours. This correlates with formation of the phase one metabolites, which are quantified in bulk here in blue. And we start to see, again, significant formation of metabolites at 8 hours that peak at 24 hours. This also correlates with induction of CYP1A1 enzyme activity in our cells, which is the black line, which we see peak at approximately 6 to 8 hours after treatment. And CYP1A1 is one of the primary enzymes responsible for pH metabolism in lung cells. I will also mention that we did see evidence of phase two metabolism by glucuronides in our cells. So if we incubate our samples with glucuronidase to inhibit metabolism, we saw approximately 50% increase in measurable phase one metabolites at the 24 to 48 hour time points, improving our overall recovery of total BAP added to the system at these time points. We are continuing to still investigate where the rest of the total mass may be at these time points, just based on total recovery of what's put into the system. But it is likely, much of it is likely due to a combination of phase one metabolite peaks that we haven't identified yet, or other phase two metabolite processes besides glucuronidation. So we use this data to first build a dosimetry model for the parent chemical benzoylpyrene by calculating parameters for absorption, permeation through cells, partitioning into media, elimination processes of metabolism and volatilization. When we overlay our predicted or simulated model, which are the represented by the lines onto our actual measurements that were collected from our cells, which are the dots, We do see that we have a very good fit of the model to our data. So in red, we see prediction of benzoylpyrene in the media, although as we presented, very little of the parent itself is moving into the media. In black, we see prediction of benzoylpyrene in cells, and in blue, we see prediction of metabolite formation. And so, as I mentioned, while we can't account for all of the potential metabolism that's occurring, our model accounts for at least the minimum amount of metabolism achieved. And so, and I'll note that while we start to see significant metabolites at 8 hours, metabolites do begin to appear at approximately 4 hours. So we can incorporate metabolite formation into the model using a very similar using similar parameters that we did for the parent itself. So calculating parameters for formation of the metabolite, permeation through cells, partitioning into mucus, as well as active transport into other compartments, and elimination of metabolites by metabolism and volatilization. So combined, this provides a pharmacokinetic model for benzoylpyrene in our cell system, accounting for how cells move throughout the system and how they are quantified in a how they are metabolized in a quantitative manner. In addition to developing the dosimetry model, this effort also helped us to establish a better understanding of the metabolic competency of our ALI model. And this can help us improve our ability to predict toxicity down the line. So we're currently working to expand our assessment of dosimetry to other PAHs besides benzoylpyrene so that we can start to make predictions for movement and metabolism of PAHs with different chemistries in our 3D model and see if we can predict based on chemistry what might be happening to chemicals within our culture system. Ultimately, what we would like to do with this data is apply it for in vitro to in vivo extrapolation so that we can translate toxicity that we're observing in our in vitro systems to in vivo systems, and then associate concentrations that cause toxicity in vitro with those that are being measured as part of our broader program through passive sampling and concentrations that we know individuals are exposed to in the environment. As I mentioned earlier, we're also modifying our ALI model to study disease phenotypes and generate co-culture. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about some of these efforts fairly briefly. So we can induce disease phenotypes during differentiation, and we're currently working with an asthmatic phenotype where cells are differentiated in the presence of interleukin 13 over 14 days to generate a phenotype where the pathophysiology is similar to what's reported in individuals with type 2 allergic asthma. And so this has been evaluated by us and by others in the literature with the phenotype exhibiting mucociliary dysfunction, airway remodeling, mucus hypersecretion, and also loss of barrier integrity. So we're interested to understand these cumulative risks to public health from combined stressors. Recent animal models have identified pulmonary inflammation from respiratory disease, such as asthma, as a possible modifier and risk factor for chemical toxicity in the lung after exposure to inhaled pollutants. Overall, asthma affects 8% of the US population and more than 260 million people worldwide. In our state, Oregon ranks fifth out of all states in asthma incidence overall. So rates of asthma in our state do exceed the national average, range between 9 and 13%, and this is particularly relevant for communities adjacent to the Portland Harbor Superfund site, which is highlighted here in gray. So it makes them a unique and vulnerable population for subsequent chemical insult after respiratory exposure to inhaled chemicals from the Superfund site. So we have characterized our model in the presence. We've characterized the phenotype itself and can measure significant reduction in barrier integrity using transepithelial electrical resistance. We can also see increased detection of mucus and mucus-producing goblet cells in the phenotype itself. So barrier integrity of the airway epithelium remains maintains homeostasis, protects against environmental factors. Barrier dysfunction itself can increase risk of chemical uptake and also enhancement of chronic inflammation. So we have evaluated our disease phenotype model in the presence of PAHs, and in particular here, I'm showing some data with a mixture that contains primarily alkylated PAHs that was collected from air sampling at a creosote site during a wildfire event in our region. And when we expose both the asthmatic phenotype and hash bars and normal cells and solid to this mixture of PAHs, we really only see further reduction of barrier integrity in the asthmatic phenotype compared to normal cells, suggesting that these individuals really may be more susceptible to chemical insult when compared to healthy individuals. So we have evaluated this through a number of ways and using some global approaches. We know that as the asthmatic phenotype and lung cells in the asthmatic phenotype respond to PAHs, suggesting that they are causing toxicity through unique mechanisms in the disease model. We're continuing to explore how individuals with inflammation-based disease may respond differently to pH toxicity. And we're also doing this by utilizing a macrophage epithelial co-culture model to effectively evaluate immune contribution. So one thing that we are exploring is increasing the complexity of our culture system to better mimic in vivo studies and use this to help us evaluate some of these highly abundant chemicals that we're able to measure associated with Superfund site, but also in wildfire smoke. We know that induction of airway inflammation is orchestrated through signaling between airway epithelial cells and macrophages. And so the co-culture model incorporates macrophage cells into our 3D model, just as another way to expand the use of these 3D models to evaluate the combined contribution of airway epithelial and macrophage cell communication in terms of determining toxicity. So, in conclusion, I just want to emphasize the importance of utilizing integrated approaches for understanding chemical toxicity. This has been important across our entire program and allows us to prioritize environmentally relevant chemicals and exposures for testing and filling critical data gaps for these understudied and undermeasured chemicals. Even within a class of what we would typically consider to be very well-studied polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, there exist a lot of data gaps. There are benefits to using cell-based NAMs combined with in silico approaches to improve our ability to translate studies from in vitro to in vivo outcomes based on quantitative understanding of dosing and pharmacokinetics in our system. We can also use these tools to improve our understanding of susceptibility due to combined stressors like pre-existing disease that are common in target populations near relevant exposure sources like the Portland Harbor Superfund site. Future studies in our, we are really interested in continuing to understand mechanisms of toxicity for alkyl pHs, including cell-specific responses in our lung culture model and in our co-culture model. So as Stephen mentioned, we also see less sensitivity in our 3D model in response to pHs like benzoylpyrene and others, you know, for broad endpoints like cytotoxicity, but for also specific endpoints like DNA damage and SIP induction. And we have some evidence that this is likely due to differential response across the different cell types in the 3D model. And so we're continuing to explore that more, as well as look at sources of variance that could contribute to inter-individual response to toxicity. So with that, I just want to thank all of the past and current contributors to all of this work within my group and also our collaborators within the Superfund program and outside of the Superfund program as well as our funding sources. And with that, I thank you and can take questions.
Okay, thank you for the presentation, Susan. It was excellent. So we have several questions here in the question and answer box. We'll probably only be able to get through a few here. First is, can you please comment on the confidence in separating the mucus fraction versus media or cells in the ALI model?
So when we are collecting the mucus, we're regularly washing the cells, generally weekly during differentiation. And so we use a similar process of washing the cells in terms of collecting the mucus fraction compared to collecting our cellular fraction. So there is possibly, some overlap in that collection process.
Okay, so next question for benzoapyrene. Well, you didn't recover much from plastic. Did the amount measured in other compartments represent the most of the initial exposure added to the system?
Yes, we were able to we did go through and look at a mass balance, and we were able to account for essentially 100% of the mass that was put into the system. And it's when we get to the later time points where we know we're having metabolism and we're accounting for some of those metabolites with the standards that we have. And there are it's those later time points where we still are working to identify additional metabolites that might be contributing to that total mass. But certainly, for the majority of the time course, we can account for definitely benzoapyrene and even benzoapyrene in combination with metabolites as a majority of what's been added to the system.
Okay, so we have time for one more question. The PK modeling in vitro is a major advance. Thank you. Can you comment on how this model and data is helping to bridge in vitro and in vivo situations? In other words, what is the benefit of this very involved work in human risk assessment?
So, one thing that we really want to be able to do is start to make predictions in our system about chemicals with different chemistries, how we can predict how they move within our system, how they're metabolized, and at what rates they're metabolized, how that is linked to specific endpoints in our lung cell system. So that we can start to identify threshold concentrations that cause toxicity and then make very specific, more quantitative comparisons to how the concentration in vitro is then linked to potential exposure concentrations where we know we have our collaborators are in the field with passive samplers measuring chemicals in the environment. We know what these exposure concentrations are. And so we'd like to be able to start to prioritize some of our studies based on both what we're seeing in terms of toxicity, but also combined with the exposure concentrations for what we know are most abundant and most important in these mixtures.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Susan. I appreciate it. So our final speaker today is Aram Han, a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Biomedical Engineering at Texas A&M University. He is also faculty with the Texas A&M Health Science Center and the Texas A&M Institute for Neuroscience. His research interests are in solving grand challenge problems in the broad areas of health and energy through the use of micro and nano system technologies. Dr. Han will discuss the fetal-maternal interface tissue chip to study the effect of environmental substances on preterm birth. So, Dr. Han, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. I guess for some reason I don't see the share screen button, so I guess somebody from the NIHS side could maybe just share the presentation. Thank you, appreciate it. So my name is Arun Hanna, faculty at Texas A&M University. I'm going to talk about organ-on-chip models of the fetal-motile interface, enabling rapid hazard analysis of environmental contaminants impacting pregnancy. Next slide. So I've been collaborating with colleagues with very much interest in looking into preterm births and the adverse pregnancy outcome. This just shows the global preterm birth rate, when unfortunately we have 150 million babies born prematurely in the last decade, and a worldwide preterm birth rate about 11% of all of the pregnancy. Next. And so there's a strong need to understand the mechanism, identify high-risk pregnant subjects, and then provide proper intervention, which is very much lacking. Next. So if you look at the preterm birth, it has a fairly complex etiology. So, some of the preterm birth is caused by infection-associated inflammation, relatively easily identifiable, and that's about 40% of the preterm birth. But the rest of them is due to a variety of different risk factors induced by non-infectious inflammation. And the cause of this non-infectious inflammation could vary a lot, and that really makes it very difficult to study this one, where this inflammation compromises, once it compromises the fetal-motile interface, that could trigger the preterm birth pathway. Next. So our team in collaboration, all of this work has been in collaboration with Dr. Ramkumar Menon, a professor in obstetrics and gynecology, University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. And together in the past 6, 7 years, together with Dr. Menon, we have been working on developing a variety of different MPS models of the female reproductive tract. Our initial work was started out with the amnion membrane organ-on-chip, then advanced, had some technical advancement, built it into a fetal-motile interface, fetal membrane organ-on-chip, and then we developed a variety of different organ-on-chip with the goal of really understanding the entirety of the female reproductive tract. Both from mechanistic understanding as well as a variety of different factors that may impact female reproduction. Next. So, amongst all variety of different organ systems, today I would like to really focus on the fetal-motile interface and the complex nature of this interface. If you look at the fetal-motile interface, in other words, the entire interface that surrounds the fetus, there are two different interfaces. One is the placental interface, which is probably most well studied, and the other one is the fetal membrane interface. And each of these interfaces are composed of multiple complex layers. Next. So if you look at the challenges of current models to study the fetal-motile interface, there are many challenges that are very similar to any other organ system, where 2D culture, explant human cell cultures have a variety of different limitations. Animal models, such as mouse model, also have a variety of different limitation. However, for pregnancy-specific, animal model poses additional challenge because the pregnancy in, for example, the pregnancy in mouse is very different from pregnancy in human. So a much bigger difference to a certain degree compared to other organ system. And non-human primate probably the most mimicking in terms of human pregnancy, but doing studies using non-human primate really in terms of cost, is really not a routinely usable tool. Explant perfusion studies at term placental have been utilized, but they are also somewhat limited. Next. So we have been working on developing this fetal organ-on-chip system for the fetal membrane specifically. A lot of initial work was enabled by two funding, one from an NICHD R1, a study of intercellular interaction that defines cell migration and transition, maintaining fetal membrane homeostasis. It was really using developing a MPS system of a fetal membrane and utilize this one to study a variety of different mechanisms. The other one is the clinical trial, part of the NCATS clinical trial on CHIP, where we were one of the 10 teams that received funding. It was a joint NCATS NICHD funding to look to develop a maternal fetal interface on a chip, and I'll use it to generate preclinical data. Next. So if I'm focusing on the fetal maternal interface on a chip, as I mentioned, we are looking into two interfaces. One is the fetal membrane, the other one is the placental interface, and each of them are composed of multiple different cellular layer. Next. And so we have developed a fetal membrane organ on a chip. We focus on four different cell type, one maternal cell type, three different fetal cell type. I'm gonna go into this particular design configuration a little bit more in detail in the later slide. But basically, it's a four concentric ring structure cell culture compartment connected by RF microfluidic channel. And so basically a four cell type co-culture system. Next, the placental interface organ on a chip, focusing on three different cell type, and it is a rectangular shape co-culture chamber, again connected by RSF microfluidic channel. So these two have been our main ownership of the fetal maternal interface that we have developed and have been utilizing for a variety of different studies. Next. So if you look at the basic key features of our particular MPS model, and they are typically a vertical co-culture model and they are horizontal co-culture model. In our case, the basic configuration is basically a horizontal co-culture model. We have two, di in this case, in this example, we have two different cell culture compartment connected by RF microfluidic channel. So these microfluidic channels are small enough that prevents passive movement of cells from one compartment to another compartment. In other words, when you load the cell into cell chamber A, they don't simply flow into a cell chamber B so that we can keep them separate. However, they are large enough to allow any biochemicals to transition or diffuse from one chamber to the other one. So these are a variety of different cell-produced factor as well as the toxicant that we would like to apply. So this is a two-chamber example, and these channels, depending on what particular part of the fetal membrane we would like to mimic, these channels can be actually filled with extracellular matrix. So on the lower right side, you will see a scanning electron microscope image of a microfluidic channel filled with a collagen in this case. So we have already of this channel, and the main reason, one of the main reason we use is this horizontal co-culture configuration is it allows imaging very easy, and we can simply expand the number of different co-culture chamber versus the vertical co-culture configuration usually limited to a two cell type co-culture. Next, the second key feature is we have so we have a localized cell loading, cell migration, biochemical diffusion. All of these are key functions enabled by this device. The next slide shows the second feature where we have a media reservoir sitting on top of the main culture chamber. So basically, we have a plastics reservoir sitting on top of this. They are bonded together. And if you look at the next slide, we'll basically have a gradient-driven media diffusion, and that enables localized media supply, localized effluent collection, and as well as localized treatment. So whatever factors that are produced by cells, they will be diffused into a media compartment so that we can sample those. When we are applying a toxicant, which I'm going to show later on, we can apply to one chamber, and then that toxicant can, depending on situation, that toxicant can diffuse from one chamber to another chamber. So we can use this media reservoir block to do to enable this one. So here, roughly the size of this initial device fits in a well of a six-fold chamber. Next. So in terms of cell source are one of the most challenging part of any MPS devices. In many cases, people are using iPSC. In the case of a MPS models of the fetal maternal interface, there are really no iPSC available. So what we do is we initially, about 6, 7 years ago, when we initially started this project, we used primate cells harvested from discarded placental tissue from a term birth. The past several years, my colleagues, Dr. Menon's group, has now made this cell, immortalized this one and developed this one into a cell line, have done a variety of different testing to show that these cell lines are very robust. So now we have a robust supply of a different cell lines derived from primary cells, and which we are currently using in all of our different NPS devices of the female reproductive system. Next. So several years ago, I started looking into where beyond, let's say, a mechanistic study, beyond drug discovery, where we can utilize it. And so in the past several years, I really had a great pleasure of working as part of the Texas A&M Superfund Research Center. This is 2022 is where the renewal started. And so I participated as a project three. So first of all, the overall goal of the A&M Superfund Research Center is comprehensive tools and models for addressing exposure to mixture during environmental emergency-related contaminant event. So two things. One is focus on mixture. Second one is focusing on environmental emergency-related contaminant event. So within that context, we looked into the pregnant woman as one of the vulnerable population, and Project C is trying to address that. And here you'll see a center overview where we have five different projects and many different core. So the project tree that really utilizes the fetal-mental interface organ-on-chip system, working very closely with many of the center components to look into the potential hazard of individual chemical and mixture, especially coming from environmental emergency-related contaminant, and how that may impact the pregnancy and potentially associated with preterm birth. Next. So, as a very first study at the early stage of this project, we have used a very well-known contaminant, cadmium. There's been a bunch of etiological studies out there. So we're using this a four-chamber fetal-maternal interface device. We basically applied cadmium into the maternal chamber and looked at how cadmium transport from the maternal chamber to the three different layers of the fetal chamber. So we can look into propagation. And most importantly, we can look at as the cadmium propagates through the different cellular layer, which you can sort of see in the illustration what I see in the figure C here, inflammatory response. We can look at how the different inflammation and cell deaths responding to as cadmium propagates. So as cadmium propagate from the lower side, which is the maternal decidua chamber, to the upper side, to different fetal layer, we can look at how cell deaths occur, how inflammation occur. So this shows that this fetal-maternal interface organ-on-chip can assess chemical transport kinetics using this device, and then also look into toxic and exposure-mediated adverse effect at the fetal-maternal interface. And so here we can see both direct result coming from a direct exposure to cadmium, as well as indirect exposure coming from other factors or other inflammatory factors that are diffusing from one cellular layer to another layer. Next. So if I'm looking at the microphysical system, which sometimes people call organ-on-chip or tissue-chip, as I sort of shown partially and alluded to, there are many unique features why people are using this MPS system. They're essentially more in vivo like in vitro system, can control the cellular microenvironment very well, can co-culture multiple different cell type in a tightly controlled manner in three-dimensional or 2.5D, depending on how the in vivo situation is. Microscopy comparable, and we also can be integrated with a variety of different feature sensor. However, next. However, if we look at whether we can use them as a routine tool and model, there are many challenges that we need to overcome. Next. So some of the challenges are it require oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes require dedicated tool and instrument to be able to use this MPS device. It has sometimes doesn't really compare, it's not really comparable with a traditional workflow in a lot of a medical lab. User friendliness relatively low, and somewhat most importantly, throughput. When I say fabrication throughput, operation throughput, that throughput is relatively low. So as I work with my colleague in the Superfund Center, that is led by Dr. Ivan Rusin here in the vet school at A&M, by the time you have a couple different replicates, couple different dose response, positive negative control, even for a single chemical toxicant, the number of experiments that you have to run easily in the several tens of. So next slide. Well, we really look into can we really improve this one. So if you look at the next slide, we have been working on increasing throughput to improve the MPS utility. So in an example of our two-chamber organ chip, which we look into both from fabrication side as well as operation side. So if you look at the fabrication side, initially this is all a microfabrication process called replica molding. So we have a master mold from which you are replica molding a variety of different polymer devices. So in a simple step is we went from a 4-inch wafer master mold into a 6-inch wafer mold, so that in a single fabrication run we can fabricate many more devices easily. And then in going from a putting individual devices into a well of a 6-well device, we created some custom devices so that we can have an operational improvement, especially in terms of device configuration. So that way it fits in a conventional standard plate assay format for higher throughput operation. Next, in a second example, this is how we configured our 4-chamber organ-on-chip device. Obviously, the 4-chamber device require a little bit more larger footprint. So we modified the device configuration a little bit so that we can still fit many of these 4-chamber, 4-coil chamber device into a plate format. So here, each of the individual array has 5 independent devices, and we configured this one so that 4 of these array fits in a standard 96-well plate format. So we worked on some design optimization and geometry to really be able to fit this one to make not only the fabrication process easier, but the operation process also easier. Next. So then we also wanted to adopt this one to an automated testing workflow. So oftentimes, fabrication of a large number of devices is one thing, and once that challenge has been overcome, then the operation becomes still a bit of a labor intensive. So main reason the operation is a little bit labor intensive, even though all of our operation is pipette based, these are individual devices. So we basically made them into an array format so that next one, so that we can use a multi-channel pipetter or a robotic liquid handling system. So we use a low-cost Opentron robotic handling system and made our device comparable here. And here, basically, about 180 MPS devices can fit into a single run. We have, and using this one, next slide, using this one, we were able to basically load both cells into all of these 180 devices with minimum error. And then we will also be able to use media loading, media exchange, as well as effluent sampling of this operation. So that was a big improvement for us because the big challenge of operation is the cell loading process, and then the every 48-hour or 48 to 72-hour media exchange process, and then the 24-hour media sampling, effluent sampling we're conducting so that we can do a downstream inflammatory cytokine analysis. So this really helped us in terms of the operation. And finally, we tested a variety of different polymer and then transitioned into an injection molding process of this device so that we can have the fabrication process even much more easier. Next. So now armed with this device, as I previously mentioned, we have this fetal membrane device and we have the placental organ-on-chip device. So we were very much interested in looking into the how the environment hazardous substances impact both interfaces to really look into this one comprehensively. So we used both interfaces and made a comparison. Next. So in our case, in addition to all the studies of using cadmium, we were very much interested in the PFAS family chemical. Because as this audience know very much, it's a very persistent chemical, major public health concern, and may contribute to preterm birth space and some of these studies coming out. So next. The hypothesis here is that MPS models can be used to study environmental toxicant, and their potential harmful effect on both the placental as well as fetal membrane interface. So specifically, we use four different PFAS family chemicals on both placental and fetal membrane interface, and we looked into both how the direct exposure as well as indirect exposure can affect the potential pregnancy risk. Next. So in terms of the first thing we do is we tested this PFAS family chemical to make sure that device surface is not really absorbing. So we tested this one on both the fetal maternal interface device as well as the placental device, looked into absorption. Next slide. We quantified this one by a LC-MS. Basically, the quick 48-hour study confirmed that there's no chemical absorption. Next one. We looked into then a direct exposure in the 2D to do a dose range finding. So this is typically how we use a 384 well plate to do a dose range finding, assess viability after 48 hours. Next one. We use a cell titer growth. So here you see the fourth one, the decedra, the maternal cell, as well as the three different fetal cell and how they respond to the exposure in terms of viability. Next slide shows the next step shows the how the placental cell respond. So you can see that they are responding differently, with placental cells a little bit more resistant to all of the PFAS chemical. Next one. Then we looked into actual device, and based on the previous dose range finding, we applied the chemical into the seizure chamber. And then in the case of a placental, we applied this one to an STB chamber. We looked into relying on gravity-driven flow, and then we looked into the response. So if you look at the next one, what you're seeing here is an incubate for 48 hours. Next. We can look into endpoint assay, LC-MS, LDH assay, and then cytokine analysis. So next slide will show the actual result. In the case of PFAS on a fetal maternal interface, you'll see how the different first of all, a propagation occur. Next one. And so the result is that PFAS propagate across the device about 10% by the time it reaches the final fetal chamber. Next. And then we also looked at the placental, how the PFAS propagate. PFAS has a bit more of a stronger barrier, so they are retaining PFAS a little bit more. Next slide. Next slide will be a viability assessment. So if you look at the viability, this is what you're seeing in comparison to next slide. You can see how placental cells respond. Next. So this just shows how the viability changes, and if you just go into the entirety of the 27 page 27, yeah, just keep going. So here you are looking at the cytokine analysis of the fetal maternal interface. The LPS was a positive control, and depending on the different PFAS chemical that you're seeing a variety of different responses. So next one. You look into how different cytokines respond to. In this case, PFDA had the most induced the most significant fetal inflammation response, especially in the AAC compared with other PFAS chemical. Next one. Now, when we apply this one to a placental interface, you'll see a different response. Next one. So what you're seeing here is that these two interfaces respond quite differently. So in summary, if you just can continue with the slideshow here, the fetal membrane, direct exposure on the fetal AAC showed cytokine responses, more reactive to PFAS, and then showed multicellular inflammatory cytotoxic response. In the case of placenta, direct exposure where trophoblast cells and HUVEC cells were more resistant. And then a robust barrier to PFAS, where we saw limited propagation. And then finally, trophoblast resistance to cell death and inflammation, etc. So if you look at the quite summary.
24, cellular and physiological impact.
So if you look at the summary of these two differences, You'll see how the fetal membrane and the placenta respond very differently. And that really shows the importance of looking into both the fetal membrane as well as the placenta. Next one. So I'll just skip the summary here. So here, I would like to kind of maybe take a last minute to look at what the future direction is. So we have demonstrated that improving a throughput is quite important to be able to do this kind of a study. So our high throughput automated NAMS model to have a practical and routine utility in a potential hazard of environmental chemical, really having a high throughput automated operation is critical. And that's really both an ongoing and future TAM we should put front and center theme, not just for our project three, but in many other projects. The second one is that enables testing broad ranges of PFAS chemical. I'm referring to tens to hundreds of different PFAS chemical. We are ongoing effort in testing both individual chemical and a mixture and how their response are different. That's another key Texas A&M Ship Front and Center theme. The next one is real world sample from disaster. Can you go back? Another key TAM Ship Front and Center theme. And then we'd like to establish this one, and has been establishing this one as a mechanistic tool to study preterm birth. And finally, we are trying to incorporate population variability into the MPS model by using cells from different individual and test the differential impact. And that's another future. There will be a key future, ongoing, somewhat ongoing and future TAM Ship Front and Center theme. So what we're showing here very much is aligned very well to our current and our future Ship Front and Center theme and how thematically it fits with the rest of the project. And then with that, I would like to thank all of the team members. So this is really in close collaboration with Dr. Menon's lab at UTMB, Dr. Ivan Rusin's lab at A&M, funded by NIH's Ship Front and Center, as well as the NCATS, some of the NCATS clinical trial on Trace MPS device, as well as the NICHC. So with that, I would like to ha happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Han. Fascinating presentation. So we have a question here in the question box. What is the film that you put in the 3D printer made of? Have you tested your construction arrays for chemicals that might affect assays? How do you background chemical levels from your construction equipment compare with the purchase wells? And is there batch-to-batch variation related to the film sources?
Okay. So first of all, I would like to clarify the actual device itself is either replica molded polymer or the injection molded plastic, which is a reservoir. The 3D printed structure is only for the guide structure. So that 3D printed polymer is not in direct contact with the cell. We are very much aware of many of the 3D printed material. Especially the photopolymer resin has a potential toxicity. So just want to assure that there's no direct contact with the cell and the 3D printed structure. That is more of a sort of a more of an experimental fixture that eventually will be anyway made into an injection molded plastic.
Thank you. Let's see, there's no other questions up. I have one. So for your experiments, you demonstrated that you can integrate the operation into a liquid handling robotic system. So how difficult would this transition be for other MPS devices?
So first of all, in our case, our MPS device from the very beginning has been a pipette operation based for two reasons. In most cases, having to use a fluidic pumping system makes it much more difficult. Second, in our case, these cell types are typically not exposed to any sort of a high shear stress. We actually did a comparison between a dynamic flow versus static no flow. And we didn't see any effect. Actually, dynamic flow is having a negative effect. So in our case, any transitioning from a pipette-based operation into a multi-channel robotic pipetting system relatively easy. And I think many other MPS devices that has a pipette-based operation and an open well structure will be very easily amenable to transition. Having said that, MPS devices that for a variety of reasons have to have a a shear stress, relatively high shear stress, such as like a blood vessel, etc. Those will be a lot more difficult to transition into a liquid-handled robotic system because of the shear stress needed. So I would say some are relatively easy to transition. Some might be a little bit more challenging to transition.
Hey, great. Thanks for your response and thanks for the presentation. I want to thank all the speakers for their great presentations today and the folks who are joining in on the webinar. We appreciate your attendance, and I want to also thank Molly for hosting this event so seamless. Thanks again, everyone, and I'll turn it back over to Molly to close this out.
Thank you. So before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's events. Just look under tips, questions, and support. So here are a few ways to learn more about the Superfund research program. The SRP website homepage link will be posted in the chat, and I encourage you to check out the various components of their website to learn more about the program and initiatives. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's Clūen webinars, please refer to the Clūen.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. We also encourage you to follow NIEHS on X, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook. You can also subscribe to the SRP Risk Learning Listserv for information about upcoming webinars. And with that, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the next session in our series on January 21st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Available on the slide is a QR code that will take you to the webinar series homepage for you to register for the session. If you are unable to attend live, an archive will also be available shortly after the session and will include session recordings and our speakers' presentations. With that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thank you so much for your participation, and thank you to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.